Okay, let's begin. I am Lanice Antoine Shelley, and I'll be your host through constructive, healing-based conversations designed to illuminate the adoptee, parents, and the adoption curious. We center the topics around community, mentorship, leadership, and healing, so you get a multidimensional view that is ultimately empowering. These are the voices who could not speak when they were young. Okay, before we get into it, I wanted to share with you some new offerings. We've just partnered with Isaac Etter's company called Identity, who provides adoption consulting and short practical guide pamphlets, a practical guide to transracial adoption, and a practical guide to Black hair care. As a listener, you get 15% off. Just click the link in the show notes where you can find all references and hot topics that are talked about in each episode. And since you're listening, I just wanted to thank those of you who've rated and reviewed this podcast, because every 5-star click helps remind these platforms that our work matters and helps me keep going. So those of you who are getting so much out of these conversations and have taken the 30 seconds to write a positive takeaway, I see you and I thank you. Those who haven't yet, now is the time, my love. Let's talk about it on Instagram after you go ahead and click 5 stars and write a review. Hello, hello, fam. How is your heart? I am very excited to get to the conversation today, which captures how I'm feeling. I'm feeling all the many layers and things. Tired, excited, overwhelmed, a little over certain situations in my life, motivated, peaceful, and like I need a long recess. So I'm going to take one on this beautiful Saturday. This conversation is incredibly important. If you have a child of another race, if your family is of another race, if you live on this human-populated planet, you will walk away more informed. My guest, Isaac Etter, is an incredible educator, consultant, speaker, activist, and social entrepreneur. He's the co-founder of Safe House Lancaster, where he is the co-executive director. Isaac also serves on the board of directors for the Keystone Business Alliance. I got so excited when speaking with him. You may hear me talk more than I usually do. Okay, let's get to it. It's good to meet you, Isaac.
Yeah, it's good to meet you too. I'm excited by your DM, and I'm glad we can connect.
Absolutely. I really want to know all about your work. I know where I follow you on Instagram, and you have a ton of followers, and it seems like you're very busy. Can you tell me more about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So my work has kind of been like a long journey because it definitely didn't start where we are now. This kind of started for me after I started like figuring out about race. You know, being a transracial adoptee, nobody really ever talked to me about race. And so I really discovered racism on Tumblr when I was like 16. Yeah. And so I was just on Tumblr and I came across this hashtag. It was a popular hashtag in 2014, 2013, called Blackout Day. And it was this thing that Black students at universities were doing in solidarity with like Black Lives Matter and like police brutality. And, you know, I was this naive 16-year-old who had never been talked to about police brutality or racism, really. And I stumbled across this hashtag because I was so into Tumblr. Like, I was one of those Tumblr kids. And it's like the whole world changed for me kind of overnight. And as I kind of slowly learned more and more, I don't really know what it was, but I just really felt some kind of calling towards talking about race. I had a lot of incidents happen. And then when I was a sophomore in college, so this is about 2-3 years later. This is 2 years later. So I was 18. 2 years later, I was a sophomore in college. I had just turned 18. And it was the year of Donald Trump. And it was also the year of Terrence Crutcher. Do you remember that? Do you remember the murder of Terence Crutcher?
Remind the viewers, the listeners.
Yeah. So Terence Crutcher was an unarmed black man who was shot by the police, I believe on the side of the highway, if I'm remembering correctly. And that was really like the first time that I felt like a police murder. Like I was really in touch with it, I guess. It's the first time I remember crying about one, and the first time like I remember like just really feeling it, especially as like this sophomore in college with limited black friends. I went to like the small Bible college, but who was really like hyper focused on learning about race and racism. And I made this post about that. I made this post just like, I think I shared this article that ironically said Jesus wouldn't have shot Terence Crutcher. And I remember it was like an immediate backlash. You know, my family, the community that I grew up with, just immediately was just like apprehensive and against that I was talking about, you know, police brutality and racism. Of course, they didn't stop there. You know, I kept sharing things. And the more that I shared, it was kind of like the more upset people got. You know, I was in college hearing things like, you know, when did you turn black? Why? Yeah. Like, why do you care about these things? Your family's white. Just like all these like really crazy comments.
It sounds like a lot of those comments are coming from white people.
Oh, yeah. All white people. You know, I went to a predominantly white school. You know, it was a small local Bible college in Lancaster. And so it's a white area. It was a white college. I mean, like everybody who I grew up around was white unless they were adopted. And so after that, and even after like dealing with like family being frustrated, extended family being frustrated, I just like really felt this like deep calling to do this work. You know, when you watch your whole life kind of turn on its head like that, I feel like people make, you know, like one of two decisions. They either go and start a new life or they just default back. And it was really easy for me to default back if I wanted to. You know, I had a whole life set up and I had white friends and I had, you know, everything I could want if I were to just drop the race stuff and not talk about it anymore. But I felt like that wasn't who I was supposed to be. And so I went on this journey to like do activism work even deeper. And so I dropped out of college and I moved to Georgia. And that's really where I started to like really get in touch with like being black on a deeper level, intentionally spending time with like tons of black people. I worked in like inner city nonprofits, and that journey and doing work there really propelled me, I think, into the work that I do now, which is like transracial adoption consulting. And in my transracial adoption consulting, it's mostly focused on racial bias and helping parents become culturally affluent and being able to actually understand how to raise their child and help them develop a strong racial identity. And so it's been a good chance for me to use my story and my pain to kind of change how parents are being taught about transracial adoption.
That's really powerful. So how old were you when you were adopted, and are you the only person of color in your family?
I was adopted when I was 2. And my brother is also adopted. He's adopted from Hawaii. So he's like South Pacific. Mm-hmm. So he's a person of color. He's about 10 years younger than I am. So he just became a teenager actually yesterday. And so he is kind of just slowly getting into those more deeper and deeper conversations around adoption and race. But for most of my life, you know, I was the only person of color around.
It's so fascinating because growing up in a white community, I grew up in a predominantly white community in Northern California with my adoptive sister, who's from the same orphanage in Haiti that I came from. You kind of have blinders on to the world, to the truths of being a person of color. And some of those blinders were consciously, you know, installed because of geography, because your parents didn't want to frighten you with the truth, whatever their story is, right? Yeah. And some of it is unconscious, right? Because there's no way a white parental unit can really prepare you to grow up as a black man or as a black woman, you know, because they essentially train you to to be conditioned to feel like you're white, even though I don't believe in that at all. Yeah. I don't feel that interracial adoptees are white. Some people believe that to be true. I actually spoke with an interracial adoptee from Korea who identifies as white.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So what do you think about that? Like your identification as a Black man, how was that brought to fruition?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I wouldn't identify as white. How that conversation has usually gone for me is that I understand the reality of my white upbringing. Like it's like I'm connected to it in the sense to where I use it a lot in my daily life. I was raised conservative. And I was raised in a very white community. And like that doesn't disappear from who we are for me. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I don't identify as a white person. I identify as like an Afro-Latina man, you know, because I'm half Dominican. But I also like really resonate and understand that like there are parts of me that come from that white upbringing. And I embrace some of those things, not the negative things, but I embrace like the kind of music that I grew up on and like the little things that aren't connected to, that don't necessarily even have to be connected to whiteness. Like a Black person can like Mumford and Son.
I love Mumford and Son.
Yeah, exactly. And me too. And like, those are kind of like, that's, I think kind of how I connect resonating with like my white side of myself or whatever that would be, whatever the whiteness is that like the culturally that I grew up in, whether it's like music or the way that I talk or whatever these like stereotypical things are, exactly. That's about how closely I would say that I identify to that.
Hey, I want to share with you something that has changed my life. It's more like someone, my therapist. Why is she so important? Well, because I want to win in this life. I want to break through the carousel of stories I've compiled that hold me back, that keep me from expanding into my full potentiality. Stories of unworthiness, not enoughness, and even stories of questioning why I am here. I also want to stop dumping my unsorted feelings on the people around me and reacting with the same behavioral patterns that keep me stuck. Conversations with my therapist have made me more confident, clearer in my intention, and more centered in my spirit. That is why I am elated that we are sponsored by BetterHelp, where you can, from wherever you happen to be right now, match with a therapist tailored to your exact needs. With BetterHelp, you can tap into a network of over 30,000 licensed and experienced therapists who can help you with a wide range of issues. Someone who you can text at any time and schedule online for either a chat, Zoom, or phone call. And if it turns out that your therapist isn't the right fit, you can switch to a new therapist at no additional cost. Visit the link in the show notes, betterhelp.com, when they were young, to get 10% off the first month. You need to click the link in the show notes in order to get the 10% discount. I want to see you win, beloved. Let's do it together. Visit the link, betterhelp.com, when they were young. Yeah, it's a tricky thing, right?
I
believe that our upbringing informs. It is not an indictment, right? Yeah. And I'm no longer apologizing for the way that I speak, for my education, for all of these things that some groups of people have assigned to whiteness, right?
Absolutely.
And they are not exclusive to whiteness. And I feel like the majority of society needs to get out of that construct that these opportunities and these sounds and these, you know, these ways of moving through the world are only designated to whiteness or Blackness.
Absolutely.
And there are those who know how to flow from one culture community to the next. Mm-hmm. And that should be celebrated.
Absolutely. I would say that lesson really stuck with me when I moved to Atlanta and when I was trying to go to Morehouse and a lot of my friends went to Morehouse. Mm-hmm. Because Morehouse is such an interestingly Black place to where, like,
you know,
I was meeting Black people that talked and had very similar life experiences to me. but came from all Black families. So it really like laid out this like diverseness inside of Blackness in and of itself that I definitely wasn't shown growing up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think it was part of the reason that I became so confident in myself as like a Black person. And like, I will say like adoptees by and large, even adult adoptees really struggle with feeling Black and like not feeling like they're like still white internally. And that really changed for me living in Atlanta. I think I really felt that even into my time in Atlanta, and even though I was hanging around like all Black people and dating Black people, like I think there were still parts of me that really felt like, oh, they think I'm white. And it really wasn't until I really like was like, whoa, like that's not even exclusive to whiteness. And like there's these people, these Black people who are seemingly like living parallel lives to me, talking exactly how I talk, come from the same kind of education I come from, like all of these things. And like, there's no part of them that people would consider non-Black.
Exactly. Blackness isn't on trial the way that our Blackness has been throughout our lives. And it's absolutely so unfortunate. I think it's a very limited view of what Black people can do and become.
Absolutely.
And I think just with the Obamas, the paradigm shifted a lot with who Black people could be. Mm-hmm. Even though there were like a myriad of of successful Black people in the world, but they weren't at the forefront in the way that Obamas have been at the forefront.
It definitely did set a different like tone around what Black people were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely changed the conversation from like Black people fit into kind of like a backwards cap, like slang stereotype, to now we have like a very like well-spoken, well-dressed, all these things that were so disconnected from Blackness. Mm-hmm. Now that's at the forefront of the main person that people think of when they think about Black people. Yeah. Which is a very interesting dynamic switch.
It is. It absolutely is. So tell me more about Safe House.
Yes. Safe House is my newest initiative. It started during the George Floyd protest. It kind of became a way for us to help young activists in locally in Lancaster really develop what they wanted to come out of protesting. So we had a lot of protesting happen here, and a lot of it kind of, I think, started to spin into just protesting without necessarily like an end goal or a goal in general. And so one thing that we did was we took a lot of the leaders of the protest and we kind of put them into like think tank opportunities where we thought about, okay, these are the issues that are affecting Black people locally. Like, here's how we can kind of centralize this issue of police brutality and racism. And here's how we can kind of streamline some of what we're doing on the street in this like mass movement that we have into pushing our local government to make change, into actually having local businesses make change, and doing all these things. So that was like the biggest part of Safe House. And that's what Safe House is kind of designed to do, is to take young, passionate Black and Brown people and help them turn their ideas for change in America into reality. Mm-hmm. We started Safe House as like a protester safety thing. Originally, like, we're called Safe House because that's what we served as for like the first week, was a safe space away from the police when people were getting pepper sprayed or tear gassed. We were kind of like literally kind of like we were a literal building that people flooded to that were injured. It had medical supplies and things like that. And then we kind of slowly grew into that place for like mentorship and growing. And through that, we kind of also became the hub of accountability for local businesses. Mm-hmm. So one of the programs that we have running now is called Anti-Racist Business and Community Group. And two of our staff members run that. And it's just local businesses that have made a commitment to accountability and growing their practices around inclusivity and equality. Mm-hmm. And so they meet monthly with two of our staff members, and they take like different lessons and they work on different ideas, and they're like open about the different things that are happening. And even if some like an incident were to happen in their business that month, that would kind of like be a part of the group, kind of a space for people to actually grow. Mm-hmm. You know, none of this like kind of like cancel thing. We're actually giving people the space to say, I made a mistake. I want to grow from it. I want to do better.
Now that is so important.
Yeah.
Because I feel that the cancel culture, it has become an Ouroboros, a snake eating its tail in a lot of ways. And I feel that people are losing track of the long game. What are we actually trying to achieve? So that's a powerful strategy.
Absolutely. Because the thing that we want is for like actual change to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, like we're not in a city like for us here in Lancaster. Like I knew that we weren't in a city where like a million Black businesses were just going to pop up and like become the majority. Like we have a very white run city. And so I felt like there was only one of two paths, is like create a path to get them on our track or just ignore them and try to cancel them. But canceling them doesn't really lead to their demise. You know what I mean? When you have a white affluent city, like they're going to stay propped up because the majority of white people don't tend to like really care. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like Black people will stop supporting something that they feel like is racist and just go somewhere else. But white people don't really tend to have that same energy a lot of the time. You know what I mean? They'll be like, well, I like that coffee, so I'm sitting still.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, my method has always been like, what does it mean for us to actively change spaces? And that's been my work as a consultant too. That's work that I did before there was like an editor consulting and a name behind it, was like actively changing a lot of the spaces that I grew up in. Especially after I moved back from Atlanta, it was like all about like, how do I actively kind of change the narrative and change the conversation and change how people are viewing? Because I was like, for a while, I was that guy. Like I was the person who cared about race, and like everybody else was just trying to like catch up in a sense, especially after Trump got elected and the conversation about race started to skyrocket.
Yes.
Especially in like church environments, you know? And so that's really where I grew up in too. And so as that conversation was happening in the church, I really became like that person who, that was the only person that they could go to, the only person they knew who was already there. And so.
What was your experience with hashtag Black Lives Matter? And I that whole movement this past year really spurred me into action to have those conversations with my family. Yeah. And I really started watching them in new ways.
Yeah.
Because none of them were putting up Black Lives Matter, not a single one. Mm-hmm. And so I actually had to create just graphics for them. And I said, here, this is what you can post. Right. So it was really fascinating to me to watch even my mom, whom I love, just deer in the headlights, like, I don't know what to do, what to say, you know? And so I started really pushing adoptive families against racism. All of that kind of narrative, Black Lives Matter, my adoptive children's lives matter.
Right.
Because these white families think that we're the exception.
Yeah.
So what was your experience with your family when it came to seeing those results? Did you see any results with your family?
Absolutely. And I like that you brought up the fact that usually we're the exception, because usually with adoptive families, and I notice this all the time, it's like Black Lives Matter. When they say that, they're literally only talking about their adoptive kid.
Yes.
And so it is an issue that I have to work on heavily. With a lot of families, but with my family personally, it was kind of like a dual effort. When I moved to Georgia, my family went on a little bit of their own process of like trying to actually educate themselves, which was a great catapult to me coming home, because you know during my time in Georgia, talking about race with my family is definitely something that like I didn't do, especially from how traumatic it was the year before. And then I also like didn't want to, you know, people really underestimate how exhausting it is for adoptees to have to talk to their adoptive family about race, or really any family member in general about race. You know what I mean? I do racial work for a living, and the last people I want to talk to race about is my family.
Exactly.
And I do it almost every day and it doesn't do anything to me. But as soon as it enters my personal life, it's like this huge weight and burden that sometimes I'd almost rather avoid than deal with, even though I have all the tools to do it. And so kind of having my parents kind of make that initial, effort on their own really sprung us into the conversation and opened the doors. And they've done a lot of their own work, from making their own posts to kind of calling out that in our church community. And also, like, my family's pastors, it's a really weird thing. And I talk about this sometimes because it really confuses me, but I guess it also kind of makes sense, which is that after Donald Trump became elected, I can only speak to, like, my particular denomination, like the denomination that I grew up in, which is the PCA. And I know a lot of other denominations did this, and I don't know how religiously affiliated you are. But they kind of, after Donald Trump and, like, you know, all that kind of breakup that happened right after Donald Trump got elected, from, like, just like the outbreaks and, like, the racist incidents that immediately happened, like, religious communities, like, took like a 180 and decided that now they were going to talk about race and try to figure it out. And so, and I'm in Georgia while all this is happening. So, like, my family's pastors are, like, all of a sudden, like, talking about race and, like, trying to, like, read books about race, which kind of springboards my family into, like, learning and talking about race. Mm-hmm. And I'm in Georgia while all this is happening. And so when I come back about a year later, like, they're all in, like, a very different headspace around this idea. So, like, all of that kind of combined led me and my family back together, which is so confusing and so frustrating.
Yeah,
it shows how toxic the church can be. One.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I felt it just now, how disconcerting it was that it only started to matter when the pastor brought it up.
Yeah, it's
that is very dangerous.
It is very dangerous. And it's very typical throughout, I think, Christian communities as a whole, which is social issues kind of matter as much as they matter to who's ever, like, in charge of the denomination. It's why we see some, like, Christianity, for example, we see some people on, like, the far left and the far right, which is that if a denomination, like, leadership decides to be affirming, then we watch the wave of the congregation kind of change its tide too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so same thing happens with race. If a church leadership decides and doesn't want to talk about race, then the conversations about race and the people who care about race either leave or they just stop talking about it. Just like a super weird phenomenon. And all I was going to say is that I think connected to it, and one thing that I really talk to adoptive parents is about when it comes to religion, because I'm not personally, like, religious anymore. I'm very connected to the church because I grew up in it and I really understand Christianity and how it works, because I study it a lot, because a majority of the people who adopt are religiously connected, especially Christianity. Mm-hmm. But most of the time with Christianity, when it comes to social justice issues, that is not a major issue when it comes to who is their leadership. Yeah. As in, like, a racist could very easily be their pastor while they're posting about Black Lives Matter. And that contradiction doesn't make sense to a lot of Christians, because Christian and especially European theology is kind of warped in a way to where they view that as, like, kind of like a mutually exclusive thing, as in, like, I can agree that Black Lives Matter and you can say all lives matter, but we worship the same God, so we're the same. But in a sense, if you both actually believe those things, you're not worshiping the same God. And so that, like, twist doesn't kind of come together. And so I really try to make that a point in my trainings to say, like, you need to make sure that if this is the path you're going on, that, like, your church community, your friend community, like, they're all there, or it's going to definitely affect your child.
Mm. Wow. That's exactly right. And I think adoptive parents in general underestimate what's going to affect their child.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they're well adjusted because they're not saying anything. And my mom even admitted that I was a very just peaceful child. I seemed very happy, positive. And she would have never thought in 1,000 years that that child would grow up to be me. You know?
Yeah.
And, but But these children do not have the language. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they are told to just be grateful, to just be quiet, to be indebted and grateful, and just mind their manners so that they won't be given back.
Yeah. It's the undertone of adoption.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Because the idea, the whole conversation around adoption a lot of the times is like, congratulations. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Not realizing that, like, when we make a fantasy out of adoption and we like talk about it like that, which a lot of communities do, it sets a precedent around it that it's like this great big favor that happened, which makes, again, a confusing situation for adoptees like us who are like, I'm having a lot of trouble resonating both of these realities because I'm hearing from everybody that I grew up around, like, oh my gosh, congratulations. I'm so glad you were adopted. We love that you were adopted. Adoption is such a beautiful gift. All these things that aren't necessarily wrong. Adoption is beautiful. But when we kind of enforce that on a child, they don't have any room to then say, well, like, can I bring up the issues that I'm having? Can I do all these things? And you never hear about biological kids going through that because nobody looks at a biological kid and goes, oh my gosh, what a blessing that you're in this family. Exactly. Or we're so glad that, you know, you join this family. That's not a typical conversation we have around biological kids.
That's not a burden that's put on a biological child.
Exactly.
And I think that there are beautiful elements of adoption, but there is a lot of trauma that is eclipsed by the fairy tale that you're talking about. And absolutely, that is the biggest issue, is that the child, their narrative, their story, their truths are overlooked because of this fairy tale. And a lot of times they are silenced because of it.
Absolutely.
But I want to talk about your activism in the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
You have the LGBTQ Coalition. What's that about?
So this is a coalition that I'm on the board of. Well, I'm actually on staff there now, but I was originally on the board of. That is the only LGBTQ center in Lancaster. So I joined their board as they were kind of in their first like beginning stages and kind of helped like kind of build that up on their board, mainly helping like QPOC stuff. So queer people of color, really kind of doing what I do, which is like, I guess the race work, but in that sector, because Black, especially queer people in like our community are really underrepresented and also don't have a lot of resources. And so one thing for me about being on that board and like kind of running their queer people of color stuff was bringing kind of more light and more conversations around what it's like to be a Black queer person of color in our community, and how it's, you know, affecting, you know, us on a mental and physical level, especially because like the gay community, at least here in Lancaster, is heavily white male dominated. Mm-hmm. And like that, like white cis males come with their own level of racism a lot of times.
Most definitely. Yeah. A lot of them are conservative.
Yes.
Too, which adds another like plot twist.
A whole nother layer of things, which makes being like a queer person of color even harder, mm-hmm. because you're battling racism on top of already feeling oppressed because you're queer. Lancaster is a conservative city in and of itself. It's like there's all these dynamics that are kind of working against each other, especially if you're a person of color and queer in this community. And so like that was really kind of like my that was my intersection, obviously, as a queer person of color. And so I really wanted to create like an outlet for people to talk about it. And now joining that staff, I've been able to also like do that and help create better programming around us talking about those things.
What do you think of the word transracial? Because I know some queer people who are adoptees who do not like using transracial.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious as to what your take on it is.
I don't really have a take on it, to be honest. I mean, I can understand nobody has actually talked to me too much about that. I don't love the word in general. Let me just say that. Like, I don't. Transracial assumes, to me, when we take trans and race, that would assume that we are assimilating to a different race.
Exactly.
And so I don't love the word in general.
Yeah. That's why I don't use the word for me. Other people can use it. That's fine. Right. But for me, after looking up trans and seeing that it's erasing, omitting something, complete assimilation to something. And I guess I am hypersensitive of that coming from Haiti and having felt that I had to reclaim my Haitian culture and being told I'm not Black enough or not Haitian enough and all of those things and having to define it for myself. Mm. So I personally use interracial, intercountry, all of those instead of transracial. I was just curious as to what your thoughts were.
No, I think that's a good, that's a good point. And I think that's something that I should even look into more. One of the main things that I've been working on right now in having these conversations with, especially adoption agency like execs, is the conversation around how we're forming such a deep bias against birth family throughout every stage of adoption, and how a lot of our language around adoption reinforces a really negative outlook on our birth family, aka like us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even when we're talking about adoption is usually, I feel like the miracle of adoption is that you went from a bad situation to a good situation. And that in and of itself creates this automatic assumption of like good and bad, which is that birth mom or birth parent is bad and new situation is good. Yeah. Yes. And that's like a huge, like it's throughout so many different parts of the adoption process that it's actually kind of scary. Because it's like when you do the initial intake, when a birth mother or birth parent comes in and they, you know, they go through this process, there's a ton of discrimination, one, in the process. And like this has been known, which is like the language isn't inclusive. A lot of times they aren't very sensitive to the birth parent's needs. And a lot of times the options aren't given that should be given. Because it is, for lack of a better term, a pipeline from like low income to adoption to white family. Like that's a very evident pipeline. And so when we start with the initial injustice, which is poverty, and then we kind of put the adoption band-aid on top of it, we're just kind of piling on these injustices, especially to birth families. And they kind of course, go to the adopted child, because then the adopted child has to answer for all these things. You know what I mean? I was told the story of my birth mom being homeless, and that's why I was getting up for adoption. And she did this really beautiful, selfless thing. But that's not a beautiful thing. The answer to my birth mother situation was not adoption. The answer to it was resources and community help and aid. And so we put this really, you know, heartfelt message around these adoption stories. And we do all these things and we kind of forget that the whole situation is a huge act of injustice, not even including us yet. Like before it even gets to the injustice that's inflicted upon us with the trauma of losing that connection, we're forgetting that the whole thing in and of itself was an injustice. Mm. And it's directly, almost 99% of the time, it's almost directly connected to the fact that we don't deal with poverty and we just punish poverty. And most of the people that are adopted, if they tell back their story, that's their story. Mother was poor, drug addict, whatever, and couldn't raise the child. Direct results, like that's poverty. All these things are interconnected to how we abuse poor people. And that's most of our origin story. And instead of ever dealing with that, we go to adoption and we highlight this beautiful thing. And that's just wrong. It's the wrong ideas. And that has to be addressed at some point. The solution has to stop being, why don't we take these children and give them quote unquote better lives? The question is, how do we stop so many kids flooding the system? And how do we create better systems around families and keeping them together? Because there are always going to be kids in the system. Like both parents are going to die sometimes. Like it's almost like this has been turned into such an industry thing that they don't want to mess up the flow. because the flow right now keeps adoption agencies in business. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They know they're never going to run out of children because there's not enough resources for single parents. Mm-hmm. There's not enough resources for people who are homeless. Mm-hmm. So the direct result is going to be kids in the system. And there's always going to be more white people with money, and they're always going to want to adopt because it's glamorized. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps feeding back into itself. The injustice has to start on that front end, which is why I always tell people that Edder Consulting isn't necessarily doing a ton of work or too concerned about the post-adoption things that happen. We do front-end training and system reworking. We train families before they adopt, and we work with adoption agencies to make their systems more inclusive and more equitable. And when we're talking about being equitable, I'm talking about from three dynamics. First, it has to be equitable for the birth parents. There needs to be a system in place in every adoption agency where when a parent comes to place, they are also given a packet of resources that can potentially help them stay together. That is the only just adoption. That is the only way to start an adoption process that is fully ethical, is if the birth parent knows every option for them to also keep their child. That's the only way. There is no ethical adoption outside of that. And if they do, go ahead.
No, I'm just, you're just preaching right now. You're preaching, you know, and this isn't an exclusively Christian or anything kind of podcast, but I'm feeling your words right now. So continue, sir.
Yeah.
Continue.
Basically, like, that's the only ethical way for an adoption to happen. And I think from there, the only way to keep that is open adoption if that's what the birth parent wants, but also to make sure that the story of the child is going with the child. I think that adoptees are also kind of, and this doesn't always work with international adoption because there's different things around.
It's around very adoptees. Complicated with
international very complicated. Adoptions,
and people don't understand. And that's one of the reasons why I'm just really excited about what you're saying right now is yes. to get down to the root of what's happening, the systemic Absolutely. Issue.
Systemic issue.
And a lot of times it is supported by the government itself. Mm-hmm. And people don't understand that it's not the simplification of, oh, the mom got pregnant and she was 15 and, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of story that's really overdone. It's very complex stuff. And if you've seen One Child Nation mm-hmm. or have encountered anyone from Korea, there are stories of the Korean government funding the 1980s Olympics through adoption.
Yep.
And so people don't understand that it is very intricate, mm-hmm. strategized, complex stuff that is happening here. And mm-hmm. you cannot glamorize it. You cannot create a fairy tale out of it. Mm-hmm. And no, these children do not have to be grateful for it.
No, absolutely. No, you're totally right. And that, I mean, I think that's the biggest, and I don't know too much about international adoption, just because I believe that that's an interracial adoptee's story to tell. Like, that's another big belief for me, is that, like, Edder Consulting doesn't do work in, like, Asian communities or communities that, like, aren't representative of my experience. I would bring in an Asian adoptee or an international adoptee to do those trainings. Mm-hmm. Because it is, like, another part of, like, our adoptee experiences is always being talked at or talked for. And, like, I think that as adoptees, we need to do a good job of making sure that we're not speaking for other adoptees, too.
Exactly. We are the experts of our own stories.
Exactly. And so I think that's really important. And I also think you can see some of those same ties in the American domestic adoption when we're really thinking about economics and poverty. And I think this has been... a big part of my work in general, from all different angles that I work in, is just understanding how the line of poverty and economics really trickles down, especially when it's regarded to Black people specifically. And even the start of transracial adoption, which in America, which wasn't even until like 1940, 40s. No, not even 1940s. I think it was like 50s or 60s.
Yes.
It was like the first case of transracial adoption. So we're not even talking about transracial adoption.
Came, a lot of adoptees came from Germany. Mm-hmm. A lot of, there was this influx of Black adoptions happening, and there are these Black babies popping up because of the war. And they shipped them right back.
Yep, it's crazy. And so we have, I think, just like this huge legacy of racism. And one idea that I think kind of goes to what we were talking about earlier is that when transracial adoption started, in regards to especially Black people, the early ideas around adopting Black kids was not as much this like warm savior thing. It was purposeful culture erasing. So the idea was that we could take these Black kids from Black communities and turn them into good people. And yeah, that was
civilize them.
Yeah, that was the mission. It wasn't necessarily like, oh, we're doing this big heroic thing. Though that those tones are there, it was really an intentional process of saying, you know, because Black people are this, if we raise them, they can be this.
Have you seen Rabbit Proof Fence? Mm-mm. You have to see it. Put it on your list. Rabbit Proof Fence. It's a film about the Aboriginals in Australia. And in the 70s, that they committed a genocide, essentially, of the all of the white inhabitants. They would abduct the Aboriginal children who were biracial, and they would try to integrate them into society. And then they put diagrams up of generationally how the Aboriginal gene became less and less prominent.
Interesting.
And wow. So that's one of my most, like, my favorite films, because it's based off a true story about these three Aboriginal girls who get abducted from their mom, and they are put into these concentration camps to try to civilize them and have them speak English and have them learn knitting and all of that to become a maid in a family for white society, and then someday marry a white man or woman and then have whiter kids along the line. But you talked about early this concept of good and bad and vilifying the biological parents, and how in a lot of these cases, people don't like to admit that these children were coming from loving homes. Mm-hmm. And in the case of this film, you see this mom who, yeah, by a lot of world standards is poor, but they loved each other, and the children wanted to be in nature with their mom and to grow up with the Aboriginal culture and to know who they are. And people underestimate the power of knowing who you are.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I know that we interracial adoptees have further along to go. Mm-hmm. Because, as opposed to a same race adoption, because not only are we in search of our cultural identity, but in many cases, our nationality. Mm-hmm. Because I my adult life have been looking for that glimpse of the Haitian that I left when I was 4 in Haiti. But I could talk to you all day about this. This is so good.
I think that's a great point.
My mind.
No, I think that's such a powerful thing you said, that glimpse of being Haitian, because I think that all adoptees in interracial situations really have a hard time finding that that connection, that like feeling of almost like fullness. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this makes sense. Like, this is who I am. I think for me that has been such a, and it's an ongoing journey. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily ever completed.
Yeah.
But I think for me, as I've kind of grown up and connected more and more with different sides of myself, like that has been a huge deal. Having Black community, having Hispanic community, having Dominican community, having community that represents all sides of who I am, that is constantly showing me different things that I didn't know about, that I didn't grow up around because I didn't have that opportunity. but it's actually bringing me closer to myself. So
yes, and that is necessary. And just to go back to our earlier comments, it's imperative for us to find a deeper centeredness in who we are, in ourselves, and how we can do that is by representation. And I did not feel that until I started to really immerse myself in the Black community.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with all of those comments of, oh, you're acting white, or you Oreo. And then on the other hand, oh, you're Black now. And all of those from either side, right? But when I was immersed in the Black community, in African dance, to be specific, I grew up an African dancer. They were like, girl, you're beautiful. You're a queen. And they really taught me how to love myself on a deeper level. And had I not been exposed to them, I would not be the woman that I am today. I would not be as confident as I am now. But that needs to be modeled, right? That needs to be seen and witnessed in these families with these children. And people try to downplay this representation that needs to happen, but it is so important to see yourself in someone else, or to have a mentor, or some activity that allows you to really come home to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually the number one thing that we talk about in my trainings, is that like the number one thing that all families need to do is change their community. Because if your community doesn't reflect your child, you're already on the wrong track. It's just true. You can't adopt a child of a different race and them be your only friend of that culture. If you're going to adopt an Asian, Hispanic, Black kid, you need to be in a community that represents them. You need to go through that learning process, that uncomfortability, all of that. Because it's not on your child to live through that uncomfortability. It was your choice to adopt. It wasn't their choice to be in the system. And so that is a really important thing for adoptees. And you can even tell, like, adoptees that grow up in community that represents them have a much better connection to their cultural identity than adoptees that grew up like us in, you know, predominantly white communities, because we had to go on this whole search and deal with all of those comments and deal with all these things. But when a family actually adopts a kid and actually lives in that community with them, they're able to actually feel really confident in their cultural identity. And instead of going through this huge racial identity search, they're able to kind of grow up consistently having people in their life that they can ask those hard questions to. And that's really important. Most Black parents, like the whole racism talk, the whole police brutality talk, all of these things are just a part of the experience. You know what I mean? And like Black kids grow up and they always have this understanding, like we don't fight police officers. Obviously we don't do all these things that white families never have these conversations about. If you're Black, if you're going to raise a Black kid, you should be in community that's having those conversations. If your community is not having those conversations, how do you expect to get up the nerve to have it yourself? I think it's like really surprising, and we all do this in different ways, but I don't know how, especially adoptive families, think that they're going to magically be able to have conversations about race when they've never had them before. And so, you know, if you're not in community that takes those things seriously, that's having those conversations, then you're not going to be able to have those conversations magically. It's just not going to happen. You're going to constantly put it off and keep putting it off. And eventually it's going to be too late, in a sense, to have that conversation when it should have been had. Just like it was too late for my parents to talk to me about race. You know, when the internet taught me what I needed to know, that was it. That was the basis and the foundation for what I learned about race. It wasn't this conversation with my family and them telling me, you know, this is the truth about what you're going to experience. You know, that's not who you are. You are not, you know, a criminal or a thug or anything like that, but that might be how the world treats you. Like, that's the conversation that should be happening. But instead, I'm just thrown into this whirlwind of emotions, not knowing what is exactly for me on the other side.
Wow. Yeah. Where can people find you, Isaac?
IsaacEtter.com or Instagram at Isaac_Etter, E-T-T-E-R.
And I ask this question to every guest.
Yeah.
because I think it's important for those who have yet to find their voice, have yet to find their sense of groundedness in who they are, to get ideas as to how they can apply courage. So where in your life can you apply courage?
Oh, courage. I think by continuing to have these conversations, and not just with other adoptees, but in white communities and in family and all those things. I think that even when our families start to have conversations about race, there's still apprehensiveness. You know, for me, I feel like I still feel a twinge of like, maybe I shouldn't bring up what happened in the news around my family, even though I know my family is on the process and trying to have those conversations and trying to think deeper about those things. I think for, at least for me, I don't know if it's like this for every adoptee, but there is still like this nervousness that they're going to say something or do something or disagree, and you're going to feel that rejection and abandonment all over again. And so I think that that's an area where I'm always working on courage, is like continuing that conversation where it hurts the most and where it matters the most, which is family.
Yes. That was so much fun, Isaac. Thank you.
Thank you.
I learned so much from you.
You're a beast.
You're
I do need that.
I'm sorry.
Oh, all I would say is it's been a huge, I think, learning process of really trying to understand, like, one, my own adoption experience, but also adoption as a whole, because so many of us have so similar stories, but there's so much more behind why we're experiencing all these similar things. And that's been really important for me to understand for my work's sake, is that if we're going to train parents on the front end, we need to understand the why behind we're all experiencing these similar things.
Here are my reflections. No one looks at a biological child and says, "Oh my God, what a blessing it is you're in this family. We're so glad you're in this family." We must dissolve the expectations so that adoptees can just be their full, authentic selves. There is no such thing as an ethical adoption. The only ethical way is for every avenue to have been explored for the parent to keep their child. Isaac's knowledge is deep and vast. I was transformed by this conversation. As you could tell, I was so excited. You can find Isaac on Instagram or Facebook, and I've included his website in the show notes below. Whew, this was such good work today. Don't underestimate the power of knowing who you are. Let me know what you think.
Another beautiful episode. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to my guest today. If you liked this episode, the best way to support me and this work is to write an iTunes review, a 5-star review. This helps us reach the top of searches and helps more people to find us. And if you personally want to connect, please reach out on Instagram or Facebook. And I have some great resource material on my website at laniceantoineshelley.com. So go on over there too. Until next we meet, go gently and have courage, my love.